right, welcome back to Stillwaters, episode 78, started at Mark chapter 15. But before that, I want to do a shout out. There is a podcast that does I would say the best I've ever heard of the Old Testament. They got some, I won't say they're Hebrews, but they're, you know, they study Hebrew, right? And they basically ask questions of the Old Testament. They figure out the Hebrew words and this, that, and the vernacular, which I think is great because I think one of the greatest tragedies of Christianity is we often don't understand the Old Testament. You hear things like that sounds weird, or a lullaby effect, right? You hear an Old Testament story and your mind instantly thinks, ah, that's what this means. That's the lesson. For example, first one that comes to my head is Cain and Abel, right? Ah, yes, the story of the two brothers and Cain kills his brother. And that's because he didn't give a proper sacrifice. And that's it, right? Like, that's the only thing you get out of that. And you just check out anytime you hear about that guy. Never realizing there's way more stuff in there. And they kind of piece it up. So that's just like an example. That podcast is called Bema, B-E-M-A, Bema. It's on Spotify. Really, they got like 500 episodes, right? So plenty of time to get a different perspective and have a deeper understanding of your word and appreciation. You never know. Why is it called Bema? Because basically I believe in a Jewish synagogue. I'm going to butcher it, but you can watch the video. I'm sure they'll do a better job explaining it. But it's essentially a square, and it's like a 1-inch platform, so it's just slightly above the ground, and that's where the stand is, and the rabbi would stand there and yap. So there you go. In any event, let's get into it, eh? So yeah, Mark chapter 15, very early in the morning, the chief priest with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans, so they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. The chief priest accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer?" See how many things they're accusing you of? But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Okay, well, I guess, Lord have mercy, I guess not replying while a guy is yapping accusation to use an impressive feat. Maybe we can learn that for Facebook and Twitter. Maybe the best response is no response. People will be amazed. That comment didn't deserve a reply. Good God of mercy. Now it was the customs at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising, and the crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. Now, I need to pause right here. I notice in a different translation, Barabbas's full name is actually like Jesus. I can't confirm on that, but I remember hearing that once. So basically, this kind of confirms this whole, he was the scapegoat, the perfect sacrifice, because they had two lambs, and they chose him, essentially, because they're both named Jesus. But, I'm getting to the weeds of it. Pick whatever Bible translation you like. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" Well, Pilate keeps calling that. And asked Pilate. Now, I wonder, when Pilate says that, is he being condescending, or is he like he's just showing proper respect? I don't know. It doesn't really say. "Knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priest had handed Jesus over to him, but the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead." Interesting. If he didn't stir up the crowd, maybe he might have been a different result. "What shall I do then with the one called the King of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate, release Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified, wanting to satisfy the crowd. Pilate, release Barabbas to them. Good God of mercy. If you knew how many times in our lives, in my life, and the lives of others, the worst things I have ever seen committed, wanting to satisfy the crowd. If I say nothing else, I've already, you could do a sermon with that verse alone. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him. They twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. Divided up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. All right. The writer, notice of the charge against him, reads, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. One thing I want you to notice in Mark's writing, Mark is the only writer that notices, that recount, that puts more detail of this character in verse 21. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander. How does Mark know this guy? Because other times it just says a man. But this guy actually gives more description. Was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. And they. Well, one thing's for certain. There's other translations of how he helped. Maybe was more willing, etc. But one thing I want to notice is, yeah, I think Mark is from Cyrene. Because how does he know this guy? He clearly doesn't know him. Like, he knows his sons. I like to think if you know someone's children by name. Now, if it was like, oh, and his two sons, I would have been like, okay, maybe this guy's just a stranger, right? Like, he just noticed a guy from Cyrene. I could tell by looking at him. He knows their kids by name. So that's a little bit of a different vibe. We also know that Mark and Luke are two disciples, not the 12, but like just kind of like with the Apostle Paul. So, yeah, I suspect Mark's not really a Hebrew by descent, but probably from Cyrene. So I think that's a little interesting homage, something to consider. Not everyone in the Bible is a Hebrew. Something to consider. God will use anybody. All that to make a bigger point. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. Lord, have mercy. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That's Psalms 22. Let's see. When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Okay. Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine, vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God," the centurion. Some women were watching from a distance. Among them was Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women have followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. Okay, a lot of women are there. Jesus had entourage doing stuff. It was preparation day, that is the day before the Sabbath. So at even approaching, Joseph of Arimathea, prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. Joseph brought some linen cloths, took down the body, wrapped it in linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of a rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. Chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they went on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? When they looked, they saw that the stone, which was very large, and I gotta tell you, it was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Tremble and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. My God, I don't know what they saw. Verse 9. When Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven demons. Lord, have mercy. I know. You're probably wondering when I read this, Andre, is this your first time reading this? Sometimes you just read... I read this stuff. I'm like, I read this, but Lord, sometimes you read it and you're like... The first time you read it, you're like, you just read it. But then you read it again, after a few years of experience, you're like, my God, it was that bad? I knew it was bad, but it was that bad? Sometimes you just read it and then you really... Well, like, there's a difference between looking at words and actually reading it. You know, just... You can feel it in real time. Verse 10, she went and told those who had been with him and who were mourning and weeping. When they heard that Jesus was alive and that she had seen him, they did not believe. Afterwards, Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country. These returned and reported for the rest, but they did not believe them either. My God, what is it going to take? Later, Jesus appeared to the 11 as they were eating. He rebuked them for their lack of faith and stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. He said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands. And when they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on the sick and they will get well." After the Lord had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and sat at the right hand of God. And when the disciples went out and preached everywhere, and the Lord worked with them and confirmed his word by signs that accompanied it. And that's Mark, guys. Here you go. Mark 16. Now, it says here the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 through 20. Now, that's interesting. So I just read to you 9 and 20, but apparently there seems to be some, how do I want to say, distrust with it. I think now I want to give some homage to an Old Testament one. I was thinking about, you know, I referenced that Bema podcast for the Old Testament, which is great. I mean, because no one, clearly pastors don't talk about Old Testament, not as much as we should. What I mean by that is it is much easier to do a month-long sermon on Psalms 23 because it's so powerful, as I've been told. There's just one problem with that. If it takes you a whole month to... No, think about this now. Now, granted, I don't know what people are doing on their personal life, so not for me to judge or be that critical. But let's say, hypothetically, you know, you go to church on Sunday, maybe you go to a Bible study on Wednesday, but you it took you a whole month. I might as well do my rant now. Let's look at this. Let's find out, shall we? Let's find out. Where are you? Oh my. Song of Songs. That's a good time. Psalms is always behind Proverbs. I'm flipping now. Let's see. Psalms 23. It's 6 verses. 6 verses, dude. 6 verses for a month? Let me see. How would you even divide this? Let's see. He leads me beside quiet waters, refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right path for his namesake. He makes me, that's probably my favorite part, he makes me lie down in green pastures. That's good to know. God will make you have rest. But it's 6 verses. Lord have mercy. It took us a whole month to get through 6 verses. In that case, hold on now. Let me look at Psalms 119. Let's have a little field day. Let's see. Psalms 119, longest verse. And it is, well, we're going to find out today. 176 verses. Okay, let me do some quick math. I know. You're like, what podcast did I get myself into? I probably should put my face so you kind of know what I look like, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there. Let's do a calculator. Okay, so 176 divided by 6. It would take us 29 days. It'd take us 30 days. So 30 days divided by 4. Let's see. Let's do that. 30. Let's see here. Oh, boy. Where's the back icon? That's kind of weird. Oh, boy. That's a weird one. Don't matter. Let's just do 30 divided by 4. It'd probably take you like basically a whole year. It'll take you a whole year to get through Psalms 119. So, here, why do I preface all that? Because if that's, maybe there's two reasons. Reason number one is because pastors are dealing with congregants that obviously don't put in the work necessary to understand the Word of God. Fine. Very well. I'll factor that in. There's just two problems with this ideology. There's two problems. Problem number one, the first problem, is you create, now I promise you this, you create an environment where I believe the narrative is simply emotion, and, well, if it takes you 6 verses, if it takes you a month to read 6 verses, like, that's actually, like, your rate of understanding. When I believe you suffer from Hosea chapter 4, verse 6, where the Bible says that my people perish because of a lack of knowledge. I know you're thinking, Andre, you're saying knowledge is the key to salvation. Well, I would argue that a diligent heart and mind, that's probably important. I'm flipping through here. I want you to look at, so you know I'm not just yapping, but it's Psalms 1. I would argue this is probably important. Blessed is the one who does not walk in the steps with the wicked, nor stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but who delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Now that right there might be the most baller concept you can read. But we have created an environment where apparently not knowing and having an emotional reaction is commensurate of faith. It's definitely signs, but I've seen the fruit of that tested under conflict. It is not good. It's not good because I still see people getting divorced. I still see people having mental breakdowns. When I say see, I mean, that lack of peace. I believe the peace that Jesus gives can only happen when you have that understanding. In the book of Jeremiah, I think it's chapter 23, whatever, but in the book of Jeremiah, there's a verse in the where he says, if you seek me with all your heart, I shall reveal myself. I think the problem is that we like the fruit of something, but we don't really like the root of it. The root in question is effort. Individual, unique effort. Ironically, it's kind of sad. I mean, we're talking about reading a book. Oh, by the way, some perspective. This book, it used to be a scroll written in Hebrew, and then Latin, or no, Greek, then Latin, and then translated to English. Now we have all this stuff in one book. So now you got all books in one. It's pretty convenient. Let's see, how many books are there? I believe it's 39 in the Old Testament, 27. So that's about, what is that, 66? Yep, 66 books. I want to do one, too, as a respect for the Bema podcast. Listen to that if you want to hear some of that Old Testament swagger. But in Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel, this is one of the perspectives I thought that was commensurate for thinking. They talked about how the reason why, now you probably heard the lullaby effect, right? Oh, the reason why Cain killed Abel was because Abel did a better sacrifice, and Cain, he just gave fruit, and it wasn't from his heart, and that's why he killed him, because, you know, it was, and then we go on a relationship rant. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not against emotion or relationships. However, I am against when we don't go beyond that. It's not mutually exclusive topics, right? I think the Western culture, and this is what Bema is suggesting, has a tendency of this means this and that's that. It's like, but in the Jewish culture, rabbinical culture, it's yes and. And that may sound like, well, that's the risk of contradiction and confusion. And yet, ironically, it gives the story more depth, more meaning, more of that humanity touch. And here's what I mean by that. In the story of Cain and Abel, they talked about how some rabbis would suggest, oh, the reason why Cain kills Abel is because what if he felt insecure? He sees God bless Abel, and he's like, oh, he didn't bless me. Maybe it's because he could only bless one of us. So if I kill the competition, he has to bless me. That's an interesting perspective. Notice how God talks to Cain. He says, if you do what is right, will I not bless you? But what if in Cain's mind, he thought, well, I did what I thought was right. It wasn't enough. Do you see what's happening here? That's a different perspective. Now, I know what you're thinking. Andre, Are you victim blaming? It doesn't give an excuse to Abel getting murdered. Of course not. But it does give a little bit of that, how do you want to call it, humanity to that character. Sometimes it's really easy to say this character's good and that character's bad. Don't be like this guy. Never realizing, I believe we actually relate to them more than we like to admit. If you just change the wording around, you begin to see how relatable we are. How many times have we hurt people? Oh, I better not get into that. Let me fast forward to the Joseph story. It is interesting because the Bible will tell you in Joseph's story, at least one of their readings, it said that he told them an evil report and that Jacob loved Joseph. Now, when we hear this story, the lullaby effect suggests Joseph's good, brother's bad, obviously. But notice that we also have to take another fact that Jacob is Jacob. I mean, we already know about this guy's persona. And he loves this son, gives him a pretentious cloak, and then the son just kind of flaunts it in front of the other sons. And he tells him an evil report. Hey, guys, I'm going to be your ruler. Didn't really bode over too well. Sometimes it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. It's also interesting how we never say it from that story vantage point, right? Joseph's the victim, and those guys are bad, etc. I like how they're able to, I don't want to say demonize certain characters, but to give you a certain perspective that all these characters at the end of the day are human. That's what you need to notice. There are no perfect characters except one. And that should comfort us because that means that maybe there's hope for the rest of us. I want you to be encouraged that you have a way of understanding this book more than you might think. The reason why I can say that with confidence is because in the book of Revelations, I'll end with this. And I actually flipped on it. That's fantastic. Revelations chapter 12, verse 11. They triumph over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their life so much as to shriek from death. Now, the reason why I like this verse is because even though this is the story of the woman and the dragon, I want you to notice this phrase. The blood of the Lamb, the power of your story, has the power to triumph over evil. The temptation in leadership and in our lives is to believe that if we do everything by ourselves, we'll be successful. And there is a modicum of truth to that. But yet in this book, it indicates to me that everyone has a part to play. And with that, I hope you feel encouraged and know that you have something with God's help that can triumph over evil that we can't do without you. So with that, I'm going to end the episode. Mark is done, so that's great. I think it's only right we do Matthew. I think that's only logical. But we'll check that out. We'll check that out. So other than that, you have a blessed day, and I will talk to you later. Deuces.